Hey, 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 friends. Thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives with me, Cam Hale. As always, joining me today, my friend over here. He's rocking the old school DJ look. He's got his sunglasses on in here because he knows it pisses me off when he wears them indoors. Mr. Kyle Filson.
How's it going, bud?
Just chilling. Son of a gun.
Right? So you notice my sunglasses, yeah. Right?
I look, dude. Does it not make you mad when you see people walking around in the store wearing sunglasses?
Or when it's like darkly lit. Like I've been in restaurants and stuff at night or like a bar and it'll be like, you know, nighttime and they got sunglasses on.
You're like, hey, cool guy. Right? Hey, cool guy. Take those things off or I slap them off your face.
It is a little bit ridiculous.
A little. It's very ridiculous. I hope everybody had a wonderful weekend, getting ready for a great week. Everybody make sure you drink plenty of water if you're going to be outside. It's getting warm down here. It's getting warm everywhere. But I'll tell you where it's getting even more warm. We're going to jump right into this little jewel.
Let's do it.
Brud, I got something that was fun. You know, look, we've always talked about, what was it, American Diggers or whatever that was. Diggers maybe is all it was. Remember, we talked about it at one time. It'd be fun to have, like, metal detectors, right?
Yeah.
Check this out. Amateurs, this comes from ancient origins, amateurs find largest ever Viking gold hoard in Denmark.
Really?
Yes. Discovered in Denmark. Was 1.948 pounds, all right, of gold. Three amateur archaeologists found this. It consists of seven beautiful worked bracelets, it says, six of gold, one of silver. The silver piece weighs about 90 grams. Now, it's at a museum that I would love to pronounce for you folks, but you know I've got a tongue like a horse. So, it says that this museum, this is what it claims, says, we are extremely excited about six gold bracelets that were recently handed into the museum. They were discovered by Paul, Christian, and Marie that make up the metal detector group Team Rainbow. And that's the museum's Facebook page that talks about this. Now, they've also got full names, but we're going to call them Paul, Marie, and Christian because I can't pronounce Danish last names without it really messing up. So, it does say that one of the bracelets was decorated in a gelling style, which is an art style that is thought to be closely related to the upper class in Viking society. It says this could mean that some of the closest of these bracelets were the closest to the king based in that municipality. Now, they had found these pieces in a field there. Now, Miss Larson told the Danish National Museum in a press release that she was using her metal detector for about 10 minutes when she struck gold.
And literally.
Literally. And they're calling them bangles. Now, you girls know what bangles are. That's what they're calling them. And they date to about the 900s. Now, she told the museum, we really felt that we had found the gold at the end of the rainbow when we found the first ring, but as there appeared more up, it was almost unreal. Now, the museum curator, Lars, I'm not doing it to you Danish people. I like y'all too much. Lars said that at the museum, we had talked about it. I talked about that it could be interesting to explore the area with a metal detector because a gold chain of 67 grams was found back in 1911. But the amateur archaeologist in the course of a few days would find seven Viking bangles. I had in my wildest dreams never imagined that. And he said the seven bracelets are likely connected to the one found in 1911. Now, Peter, I can pronounce this, Peter Pence, that's the Denmark National Museum Viking expert, said to find just one of these rings is huge. So it's something special to find seven. He says that the Viking Age is actually the Silver Age when it comes to hoards. And that the vast majority of them contain only silver. If there's gold, it is always a small part, but not like here. This is the majority. So how amazing would that be? Now, they go in and they talk about the classes of people of the Viking right. That would have this and things. But it's something like that. Mr. Pence, of course, went on to say that it would be interesting to examine. There's a wreck site that they want to go look at. And he believes that it would help be a little bit more enlightening to that area. And there might be some valuable treasure in that area that might tie into this. So they're still looking into more and more of this. But just think of that.
It's
think
cool.
Of that with your friends. You know, you start something like that. You know, like you and two of your buddies get together. And y'all are going out where you know that there might be some stuff. You've done your research. You've done your homework. You've read your books. You've looked at your maps. You've plotted what you're going to do. 10 minutes into it, you just uncover seven bangles that were, you know, back in the 900s. Nah, no big deal.
That's awesome. I mean, what would you do if you happened to find an artifact like that? Would you melt it down and sell it immediately at a jewelry store something? Or would you just put it up in your house? What would you do? Because I think I would save mine. And donate it to like a museum or something?
I would definitely donate it to a museum that had Well, here's the thing,
I mean,
man.
Not for free. I would want some money. I'd be like, look, I'll give it to y'all. Can you give me like 60% of what it's worth and, you know, weight in gold?
Well, here's my the challenge, I guess you could say. If you found something like that here, no one's going to believe you. We've covered these stories before and no one cares. They always, every time you find anything has to do with Norse, they're like, nope, not real. Roman coins on the Mississippi, not real. All that stuff. So I would love to say, look, I found this. This is where it came from. They're not going to believe you, you know, where it's expected. Like if you had found a bunch of arrowheads or some pistols from the Civil War, that's believed to be here. But if you found something out of place, it would be like them over there in Denmark finding a bunch of pistols or something, or a bunch of things that would be found in North America, let's say, around that time, but found over there. It would be one of those out of place artifacts. But I would probably, more than anything else, want to make sure it got to the into the right hands. I would probably contact somebody over there, somebody that deals with a Viking, like the National Viking Museum, this Peter Pence guy or something. If I found something like that, why not contact him first to verify that's what it is before you told anybody over here? But I would definitely have to make sure my findings got into a museum.
Yeah, that is cool. Well, moving on, did you see this over here at Who Forded, The Week in Weird by Greg Newkirk? He posted this new article, it's pretty interesting, about Indiana's haunted grave in the middle of the road. Now, I've never heard of this, but you're right, you heard it right, folks. Grave in the middle of the road. There actually is a grave somewhere out on County Road 400 in Amity, Indiana, where there's a grave actually in the middle of the road. They've actually paved the road around it. Now, the article talks about for over a century, road crews in Indiana have been terrified of this disturbing grave. And you might wonder why a lone burial plot would cause so much fear. And for that answer, we have to go all the way back to 1808, well before road crews began painting white lines on fresh pavement. The town of Amity, Indiana, was just a small village that popped up near Sugar Creek. In 1808, 14-year-old Nancy Curlin married William Bartlett, and they had 11 kids. And then she passed away 23 years later at the age of 37. Her dying wish was to be laid to rest on her favorite piece of land overlooking a creek. Nancy was the first to be buried on the hill, but she was soon to be joined by enough locals that an official cemetery was built around her grave. Now, fast forward several decades later, and the county decided that it was time to pave a new road. Unfortunately for the developers, they hadn't planned for the small cemetery to be directly in the path of their new route, and eventually they decided that they would just pave over it. Well, that didn't work out so well for them. See, Nancy's grandson was a man named Daniel G. Dottie, and he was so incensed that the remains of his family would be disrespected, he cocked his shotgun and set up camp on his grandmother's plot, threatening any worker who dared approach the mound that he would shoot him. Now, Daniel defended the patch of land for several weeks until finally the county threw in the towel and they agreed to leave Nancy's grave untouched. Having already paved the road up to that point, they had no choice but to split the lanes down the middle and work around the plot. In August 1912, Nancy's grave received a historical marker, officially cementing its place in the legends of Amity, Indiana. Now, for over 100 years, the site sat relatively untouched, but that hasn't stopped it from gaining a reputation as one of the most haunted cemeteries in the entire state. Late-night visitors have reported everything from phantoms appearing in front of their cars as they approached this mound, to disembodied voices whispering in the night, to even electrical problems with their cars when they near this grave. It's almost as if Nancy can't get any rest with the traffic so close by. Well, looks like the spirits in the middle of County Road 400 are about to get even more restless, he says, as archaeologists have disturbed the site again in order to make room for wider lanes. But in so doing so, they actually made a startling new discovery.
Uh-oh.
At least seven other bodies were buried in the supposedly solitary grave. Now, University of Indianapolis archaeologist Christopher Schmidt was called in by the Johnson County Highway Department to help them safely assess the new construction, only for him to discover that someone had dug up the remains of a number of other bodies that were dumped in that one plot. This excavation, which should have just taken the week, ended up taking over a month, with the bodies of four children, two women, and one man discovered. Listen to this.
We have the Barnett grave, which sits a few feet above road grade, and in its current condition, it's too high. And so what we're going to try to do is lower that mound so that the grave is more road grade. So the grave is going to stay where it is. It's just we're going to lower it, and because that mound's going to drop, we have to remove the remains temporarily, just for a couple of weeks. And in that time, we'll study the remains a little bit. We'll bring those remains back here, and they'll be reburied on this spot. One thing, we're hoping that we have remains that have been preserved. And what we'll do is we'll look for evidence of age, sex, and ancestry, diet, disease, those sorts of things. It's hard to say what do we expect, because every individual is so unique. You know, sometimes people, they're a certain age when they died, but their skeleton looks a lot older, or looks a lot younger, or there's evidence of a profound disease, or there's no evidence of disease. So really, each time we're studying something, it's a surprise, and we really go into it with a very open mind. We really don't know what she's inside. So it could just be a pine box. It could be a little more elaborate than that. Given that it's a rural grave, I think we're leaning more toward being a pine box, but we really don't know. And we don't know how well that would have preserved over all these years. Usually they don't preserve that well. Just you'll find some coffin nails and some wood, things like that. We don't expect to find an intact coffin. It is possible that human remains are fairly close to the surface, so they're checking to make sure that human remains aren't being exposed at this point in the study. That will come later.
As far as I know, this is the only grave in the middle of the road in the state of Indiana, so it's a very unique part of Johnson County history.
So if Mr. Dottie's story is correct, he wasn't just protecting his grandmother, he also prevented all the graves from being moved. Now it says that these stray bones are currently undergoing DNA testing, you know, just determine just who they belong to. But that's pretty neat, because even now, when they widen these roads, they're going to put her body right back where it was. So the highway, like I said, you can go on the internet and look at photos of this, or you can follow the show links, and you'll see what I'm talking about. The highway actually goes around her plot.
Well, good.
It's pretty interesting. And it's, right? I think it's cool that they're widening the road, they're doing construction, they're going to study her bones, and then they're going to put them in a brand new coffin and put it right back where she belongs. That's pretty interesting.
I do. I like that. Yeah, I like that. Sorry, while it was going on, my phone is over here buzzing because our good friend, Mr. Jeff Foster, was accidentally called the show while he's trying to text me a question. I don't think anybody heard it. I'm like, Jeff, I got something neat here, because the reason this caught my eyes, for two different reasons. Because first of all of y'all give me a load of crap about the shark business that I don't like. But second of all, it was interesting because there's a key word in there caught my mind, or, you know, caught my eye, if you will. When I bring up the names, and Kyle, I want you to remember this. You remember a story about the Palmar Atoll with Matt Graham and his wife, Eleanor, they called her Muff, and the murders that took place on that atoll. You remember them talking about all the sharks around that atoll, remember?
Yeah, I do remember
that. The guy killed them, and it was like Buck Walker was involved. We did a whole show on that. Well, this comes from Live Science. It says this: if sharks at the Pacific Atoll of the Palmyra used Google Maps, they'd see a lot of red dashes for traffic in between 7 and 8 o'clock in the evening. That's right, folks. It says sharks' evening rush hour is discovered. Shark traffic in and out of the lagoon at the Palmyra Atoll, halfway between Hawaii and American Samoa, peaks during this hour. There's been new research published in the Journal of Experimental Marine Biology and Ecology. Now, Kyle's got last month's publishing of that, so when we get this month's, we'll read some more about it. It says the sharks travel through a deep channel dredge during World War II, which is also right there, what was going on that atoll prior to that, before all this murders and stuff. It says their numbers were counted using military sonar technology. Now, the lead study author, Douglas McCauley, he's a marine biologist at the University of California there in Santa Barbara, actually had this to say about it, folks. Sharks are in trouble worldwide, so we need to be thinking about new tools and new technologies for studying them.
No, they're not. I'm totally fine if they're not around anymore.
And this one, I'm not arguing.
These giant monsters that'll eat you.
Yeah, I'm not arguing. It says, which was designed for scientific applications, works very well. Now, the shark survey that they did, they counted swimming sharks in and out of the lagoon with dual frequency identification sonar that uses sound waves to create images in dark, choppy water. Basically, they say it's a method that roughly is like an ultrasound whenever the woman gets, you know, checked out. Over the course of a month, McCauley and his team maintained their sound gate, is what they call it, at the entrance of the lagoon. They gathered 443 hours of observation and 1,196 total shark sightings. This is in 30 days, folks. The highest number of sharks seen at one time was 10. Most were smaller species, such as black tip, which is usually under 5 feet or 1.5 meters. But it says the Palmyra Atoll is a shark paradise. According to the Nature Conservancy, the reefs surrounding the atoll represent a healthy marine environment and one of the few places where sharks can be studied in natural population numbers. And we already know it's all, you know, all the stuff that goes on that place. But it did say this, that it's also home to sea turtles, red reef fish, and giant clams.
Well, it makes sense because yes. Palmyra Atoll is nowhere near anything. So no one's there. There's no humans there. You know what I mean? There's
no one living
on that atoll. There's not a town. There's not an airstrip. There's nothing. So no one's there to disturb them.
Yeah, you're right. Well, there's another marine biologist that was helping Macaulay. His name's Paul DeSalis. And he says this. He says, through this study, we are able to confirm that large sharks do indeed transit in the Palmyra's lagoons. The data allowed us to get a quantitative understanding of size classes and when these big sharks are using the channel. They're studying the shark behavior in a healthy environment around that atoll. And what they're saying is they're trying to figure out how the best to conserve them in places where their numbers are threatened. And Macaulay, in closing, says this. He says, this matter, it's important to know for how we deal with sharks and to determine their behavior patterns, basically so they can try to save them. I don't want to sound like the negative Ned, but I'd be okay. I don't know what kind of implication it would do, but I don't want the sharks around, but that's just me.
Right? I mean, who cares?
I guess it's, you know, I know they have their job in the circle of life, but man, they're just
But we're taking that job. We're eating all the fish. Human beings are consuming all the fish in the ocean.
I don't know.
So we don't need sharks, right?
It scares the heck out of me. Yeah, I don't like any of this nonsense. The sharks, but the whole thing is, it's funny because remember they talked about he threw their remains in a box and for the shark and all this stuff whenever he had butchered had killed them and you're thinking how many sharks are really around them? Well, apparently the tales of the people seeing all these, you know, he said that this bay was full of shark, right? Full of shark. Well, apparently it's real. It really was full of sharks,
right? That's incredible. I mean, am I the only one that has a problem with all these sharks numbers going down? I mean, I know you don't, or do you?
Really?
I know people are gonna hate on me for that, but I mean they're horrible. If you get in the ocean, they'll eat you.
That's why I don't get in the ocean. Look, I know it's supposed to be, but yeah, I don't.
Yeah, save the email. Send all the emails to Cam. Moving on with other animals that will kill you. Did you see this? This was on Gizmodo. This is pretty cool. About a woman was stalked for 12 hours by a starving wolf. Last Friday, Joanne Barnaby went mushroom picking in a forest near Fort Smith in the Canadian Northwest Territories. It was an inauspicious beginning to what would end up being a 12-hour ordeal, one involving a desperate wolf, swarms of mosquitoes, an unwitting bear cub, and a can of beer. Now, Barnaby, along with her dog Joey and her friend Tammy Cauldron, went looking for morel mushrooms in a forest that was recently ravaged by wildfires. The two friends eventually became separated, leaving Barnaby alone with her dog Joey. Now, once her pail was full, she headed back towards her truck, and that's when the trouble started. I heard this growl behind me. There was a long, tall, very, very skinny wolf, a black wolf, and his legs were spread, and his hair was standing, and he was growling and baring his teeth. Now, Joey charged, but the wolf didn't back down. Barnaby saw that the wolf was desperate, and she told the CBC that he looked weak, old, and unhealthy. She said, I don't think Joey expected that. The wolf began to force the duo away from the truck and the highway. And then it dawned on Barnaby, the wolf was deliberately trying to wear her down and separate her from Joey. Now, over the course of the next 12 hours, the wolf remained relentless, pushing the two further and further away from the truck and highway. She said, at this point, I knew I was in trouble. She soon became dehydrated, and her calves and thighs began to ache. The only thing that she had with her was a can of beer, which she later described as a silly choice. Now, adding insult to injury, the wolf wasn't the only thing she had to contend with. She said, I was going crazy with mosquitoes. There were zillions of mosquitoes. Then around 4:30 in the morning, she stumbled upon a bear cub, and she made the incredibly risky move of approaching the cub, knowing that the mother would be nearby. She thought that the mother might tackle the wolf as if it was a threat over her. So she made the harrowing choice to walk towards the cub. Incredibly, her plan worked, Cam. After luring the wolf to the cub and then making a hasty exit, she said this is when the you-know-what hit the fan. She said, I heard big crashing behind me, and I realized that the mama bear was attacking the wolf. Or maybe it was the other way around. I don't know for sure, but I don't think the wolf was winning. Whatever they were doing, there was a lot of fighting, and I could hear a lot of crashing, and I could hear the wolf yelping. I could also hear the mama bear growling, and I could hear all this stuff crashing. I didn't care. I just took off. Now, that was the last she heard of the wolf, but not the mosquitoes, which were still driving her insane by this point. Barnaby and her dog found an eventual lake where they were able to replenish themselves. She used the empty beer can to keep pouring more water, and this became a handy device. After all, it probably saved her life. Now, she was later found on the road and rescued thereafter by a Royal Canadian Mounted Police officer. Now, that's pretty crazy, right?
Yes.
Here's the cool thing. You know about all the wildfires up there in Canada. That's probably where she was doing, in this area, which probably explains why the wolf was starving as well. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I feel so bad for them dealing with those wildfires.
Oh,
man.
I know. But the wolf, I mean, how smart is it? It was intentionally pushing her away from the truck and the highway.
Yes.
It wanted the driver more out into the wilderness.
It was cutting her away from the pack.
Man, that is cool, right? So 12 straight hours. That's a good choice. I mean, a very risky one. But I like the fact that she knew she was in trouble. Her body's aching. She's wearing down. She knows that she can only keep this up for so long. She sees a baby bear cub and decides, I guess at this point, look, I'm going to die either way, either by bear or by wolf, so I'm going to take my chance. I'm going to rush at this cub, and the mama bear is going to see that wolf, and it's totally going to forget about me. Which is...
That's pretty smart thinking,
right?
Really.
You
talk about on the fly.
Right? The bear may not know what a human is, but it definitely knows what a wolf is.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what happened. When the bear saw the wolf, it went after it.
Be the
and
wolf.
She was able to get away. Yeah.
Oh, man.
Just pursued this possible meal for 12 hours only to get eaten by a grizzly bear.
Bump, bump, ba-ba.
Right? Pretty cool story, man. Look, you know, we were talking and laughing about sharks and wolves and stuff. We always talk about on the show, get out in the outdoors and have fun. But I will say this. If you're going to go in the outdoors where there's animals like that, take some bear spray, man. Take a gun. Well, take something, because you never know when you might be the one being pursued by a pack of hungry wolves. It happens, right?
Educate yourself, people, on anything that you're going to go do. People take the outdoors for granted, and they take it for granted because it's right there. And you got several friends, like we've had friends of ours that Kyle and I have taken camping for the first time when they were in their 20s. They had never spent the night outside. And we would take them with us. We took them with us to the woods. We took them on their first fishing trip. We're talking dudes 23, 24 years old, had never done it. And so you just out of the blue go, it'd be like me going and trying to, I'm going to go fly a plane, or I'm going to go drag race, or I'm going to go run around New York City. I don't know anything about that. You put me in there, I'm totally out of my element. So before you just get a wild hair and be like, I can do that, educate yourself first, people, just to be safe. Just do a little reading, a little education. Throw a few things in your pack. Throw something in it for extra water, maybe a little emergency blanket. You can buy them for like a dollar. They look like tinfoil, but they're real tough. They'll keep you warm throughout the night, real thin, where you won't die. Just right. A few things like that. Educate yourself before you get out in the woods, and then you come out in something stool because you was trying to run away from a wolf and ran into a bear.
These things happen, so it is scary. Speaking of scary, after the break, Cam's going to be talking about something truly scary. The Hoyabachu Forest. It's pretty disturbing, so stick around, folks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
All right, amigos, let's see if we can't make a little creepy time right quick here in this segment. Philly, I got a quick question for you. Let's get this rolling. If I bring up the word Romania... Talking about the country Romania.
Mm-hmm.
What crosses your mind? The very first thing.
Female gymnast.
Okay, that's not what I expected. But anyway, now we know where his mind lays. Most people would probably think of Transylvania.
Right, yeah.
And
vampires, right?
Okay, that's what I was going to get into next. When you talk about Transylvania, the first thing everybody goes to is what? Vlad the Impaler, right?
Yeah.
Jump right into that idea of all the history behind Vlad, you know what, Tepish or whatnot, the real, you know, alleged vampire. There's a few other strange things in Romanian folklore, though, that I want to talk to you about. Piccola Seely. Piccola Seely is a werewolf in Romanian folklore.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Now, they say that the latter, sometimes it is said that this, what they name it here, can symbolize basically a goblin, something that has wolf-like characteristics. But it is said to be an undead soul risen from the grave that's out to harm people, kind of like a shape-shifting soul, but that this one always resembles a wolf or large dog, which is pretty strange because, you know, we don't really have things like that. What we have is a flesh and blood creature in North America. You know, you think of things like that as far as what we're talking about. You're talking about like a soul, basically, a possessed soul that turns into a werewolf.
Right.
It's pretty interesting. Even in modern times, many people that live in the rural areas of Romania, claim to have been attacked by, get this, abnormally large wolves.
Really?
They also say that these wolves attack silently, move silently, and only attack solitary targets.
It kind of reminds me of the early stories from France.
Yes, it does, right?
Where they're talking about giant wolves, killing settlers and things.
Yes. Well, there's also a neat little fae story from Romania, Sanziana. They're gentle fairies, and they say that they play a very important part in local folklore. And what it does, they actually have, it designates an annual festival in the fairies' honor. There's a certain little area there for them. But it's just what they say, this word, Sanziana, it basically means holy saint or saint holy. But they believe it to be fairies. Parts of the Carpathian Mountain areas in Romania celebrate a holiday in June. It's actually on June 24th of this holiday of the Fae. It's similar to the Swedish midsummer holiday. It's a pagan celebration, or believed to have come from a pagan celebration of summer solstice, which, you know, we know the days of the first day of summer is coming up soon, so it's going to be involved in that. But it's neat that there's a little bit of like a saint's day, but there's some rituals. Basically, the ritual takes place in the practices of the folk way that they take the beautiful women in the village, they dress them all in white, and they spend the day searching and picking these flowers and things, and they're instructed to remain alone and unseen, and no males can see them. They don't want men watching them. And the flowers that they've picked, the girls create wreaths or like floral crowns, and they wear on their head. So that kind of gives you an idea, right? So
right.
At night, they come back, they have all the flowers in their hair. You can only imagine how beautiful it must look. Beautiful women, all flowing white dresses, all things. It would look very fae-esque, right?
Yeah.
You would think, okay, that's awesome. They believe it ensures fertility in the family land. So it's, you know, it's one of the pagan holidays or pagan rituals where you can ensure a good harvest. But it's neat that it goes back to where that's what they believe the Fae do. They're dressed like the Fae, very flowing, very beautiful. It's a big part over there in Romania. There's another little thing. Now, let's see if I can. Spiridus. Now, Spiridus is a creature that they say can be either good or evil. It's very diminutive, and it looks similar to leprechauns. So they know that those live out in the woods. But the wildest one here, Muma Padruli. Muma is an ugly old woman, very mean, that lives in the forest. And that name literally translates into the mother of the forest. It's an archaic word or version, Muma, or Mama, for mother. Now, there's a fairy tale, of course, in it, and it's the spirit of the force of an ugly old woman, and says that they believe that sometimes she has the ability to change her shape. Now, she lives in this little house, dark, dreary little, you know, I guess for the lack of a better word, you would think of it as the Hansel and Gretel house.
Right, yeah.
And the reason I say that is because that's where Hansel and Gretel stories come from, is that's her, Muma Patrulla. Uh-huh. That's who this, she's based on this whole story, and that it ends, of course, with the kids getting free, but it is said that she steals children. If a mother was to give birth to a child out of wedlock, Muma would come and torment her, try to steal the baby, and even try to burn your house down.
That's not nice.
No, not at all. Now, there are, of course, what they say is a demonic entity, which is another shapeshifter that punishes women for working on Tuesday evenings. Martoli. Now, Martoli, she's a little bit of a rough thing, if you will. She'll, like, rip your guts out, hang them on the walls. She likes to take people's children. She's a little bit out there. So I lay all this down because there's even another entity that Romanians believe in, Jomarita, and it punishes lazy children on Thursdays. So I'm pretty sure these two people would be really busy around my house every week.
Why on Thursdays?
I don't know. Why on Tuesdays? So they go after women, you know, the whole thing. Yeah. So all you moms and all you kids, be careful. Be glad you're not living in Romania. But I tell you all this to get into this. I want you to picture for me, if you will, a forest. And not just a beautiful forest. We're not talking about with the butterflies and little paths and running brooks. I want you to picture something scary. Something that's always about an uneasiness about a forest. Always uneasiness about the woods. Especially at night when it gets dark. Are you looking at dark timber? You can't see too far off there. And imagine these old trees, gnarly and twisted. Leafless limbs twisting and tangling up into the tops. Thick underbrush, deep shadows, sounds that you really can't imagine what's making them or where they're coming from. The echoes of howls from long away. That's a truly unnerving experience if you're standing outside that forest. Now, normally, it's no big deal for us. We all live in towns and cities and on the edges of cities. We don't see that. So you think of it as nothing. But what if I was to tell you that there's more to it than just nothing? That there's a little sinister patch of woods in Transylvania that is just that. That very thing. What I just explained to you is a lot of where this folklore comes from, is this patch of woods, this patch of area. People in the town around this place, and even all through Romania, view this with the home of werewolves, vampires, ghosts, goblins, ghouls, pretty much anything you can imagine that would be dark and sinister, that live in what they believe is a cursed forest. Now, this place is said to be the world's most haunted forest, situated there in Romania, near Cluj-Napoca. It covers 250 hectares. The name of this forest is the Hoiu-Baciu Forest. And it has grown in reputation year after year for intense, paranormal, and unexplained activities. It's even been referred to as the Bermuda Triangle of the country. Now, there's been reports of faces appearing in photographs that weren't visible normally, unexplained apparitions, ghost-like things, sightings of UFOs, all of these things. Very wild, though. There's visitors to this forest now, and they often report very intense feelings of anxiety and the feeling of being constantly watched. Another strange thing about this forest is the local vegetation is very bizarre in appearance, and some of these trees that I discussed are very strangely shaped and twisted, and there seems to be a charring that they cannot explain on the branches and the tree stumps. Now, locals have a very long tradition of avoiding the Hoiu-Baciu Forest. And it derives its name from an unexplained event that happened. The legend states that the Romanian word, baci, stands for sheep herder. And there was once a sheep herder who, of course, tending his flock, looking for a place to move his sheep, thought, well, heck, the forest is untouched. It's probably a good place to graze it. I'll take my sheep in. So the sheep herder and his sheep, some 200 of them, corralled themselves up into the forest. It was very dense and dark. He pushed them further and further. He was never seen again. There was an immense search by all the locals looking for this herder. There was never a trace of this man ever found. Even stranger, there was never a trace of the 200 sheep that was said to have been with him ever found. It looked as if he had just stepped into a hole in time and vanished. That's when it started gaining the notoriety of a place of immense dread, danger, and the folklore started to take off. The people of these areas, well, they also believe that this forest holds the ghosts of the peasant people who were violently murdered in that area. And they also say that if one enters here, with her own murderous thoughts that the forest itself will show that person for what they really are before exacting punishment. Now, it has a very ominous reputation for being cursed and being haunted. So most people of the area go nowhere near the forest. And for a long time, in their culture, it was believed to be bad luck if you even spoke of it. And in some areas, it was taboo to even bring it up. You couldn't speak its name. Now, most people that live near the forest are afraid to enter it. Of course, why? Due to the stories that they've heard. But there are a few brave locals, if you will, that decide, you know what? That's not enough for me. I think I'm going to go in. I want to test it out. I'm going to show my manhood. And I can picture this going down. We all have these places where we've grown up. Maybe it's a bridge over a river. Maybe it's a haunted playground. Maybe it's a haunted old house or an abandoned old warehouse. You got to go through there and spend the night. You got to jump off that bridge to be a man. You got to jump off this cliff into this old rock quarry full of water to be a man or to be a woman or to be part of the club. You got to be, you know, not afraid. So I can only imagine what this forest does for the young folks that really don't want to believe in this. But it's said that those that go into this forest, if they come out, they come out complaining of physical harm, migraine headaches, burns, nausea, rashes, scratches, vomiting. Multiple strange sensations happen to their person. They have no idea. Now, there's a common occurrence reported to most everyone that visits any of this part of the forest, and it's a very intense feeling of unease. We spoke of that before. It's usually in a place of dread. If there's a lot of danger, if there's ever been a lot of death and darkness in this area, usually that energy feels to carry over and you feel uneasy. Well, this forest provokes that in the people. It's also said that it's not uncommon for these people to experience a heavy set sense of anxiety, of being watched like we've discussed, sudden fear, sudden panic attacks. Here's a strange one for you folks, excessive thirst. For no reason other than just being there. They say there's the strongest urge to flee. Nothing there, they can sense no danger, but they get the overwhelming urge to run, to get themselves out of there. I bring that up because I want to ask you, and I'm going to ask Kyle, is this due to there really being some energy, there really being something going on there, or is it because it's your mind playing tricks on you? We've all been down that path where your mind will play tricks on you from time to time. Is it built up so much, or do you think maybe there is something to this a little bit?
Yeah, I don't know. It does seem that certain places around the globe, wherever they are, they do have this energy. I don't know if it's negative is the word, but it just doesn't feel quite right. And of course, if you were growing up in this, if you grew up in that area, and you've heard these stories told by your grandparents and your parents and aunts and uncles and things, and other kids you play with, I can imagine if you go into the woods and you've heard those stories and you get that creepy energy, I don't know, does it cause you to hallucinate or make something a little more out of something that wasn't, you know, it might be a wild dog or something, and all of a sudden you're seeing it as possibly a werewolf walking around all fours. I don't know. I think that kind of stuff does happen. Or is it truly an area of the world like Bermuda, like the Bermuda Triangle, where the veil between two parallel universes, for whatever, or dimensions, it's thinner there, and sometimes things cross over. I don't know, but I like to think that there's places like that on the planet.
Well, I'm glad you brought that part up, because here's a really interesting thing, that there's accounts that come from this forest, the people that have visited, of not only losing consciousness, but they wake up in a different area of the forest from where they passed out at. They have no idea how much time has passed, and they have no idea how they got to that area or what occurred to cause them to pass out.
Right.
They've also described a few that having powerful memories from their past come blasting into their psyche. And then once they leave that area, it starts to fade, these memories of their past. It might be almost like past life memories. So it's like you said, is this where the veil is thinner, where the world's you know, everything blends? Is this one of those points? Or is this an area of a concentrated energy, like a ley line? You know, something along those lines would be the only way that I guess you could say would be the way it worked. Some people even reported an experience of what they would say would, what we would call, and researchers would call, an astral projection. They said that they had seen them, they'd passed out, and they had seen themselves laying on the forest floor because it felt like their soul or their, you know, their minds were floating above their bodies, looking down on themselves. And then all of a sudden, boom, they would just get crashed back into their body and they would wake back up in their physical form. Which is strange, because now you go back into, like we just discussed, this almost is some kind of strange vortex, I guess, for the lack of a better term, that would be going on there. Now, another thing we talk about is physical sensations of electrical shocks, gusts of cold feeling, this touching feeling all over your body, like a tingly fingertip touching all over you. There's also another part, though, that doesn't just affect you now. There's been a very wide array of strange apparitions spotted in these old gnarly trees. And travelers in the area told old tales of often hearing voices or laughter, and then faces would flash into existence in front of these people. And they would appear, like we discussed, in photographs. If people were visiting this and would take pictures, there would be faces in the background that nobody had normally seen. So it's almost like there's trapped souls in there laughing or trying to reach out for you. Here's another thing. People reported seeing distorted faces, very disfigured, materialize in the trunks of these trees there themselves. So you would see a face kind of bulge out of this tree and even in the branches. And also reports of, get a load of this. Now, we always talk about the fog being the veil of strangeness. There's reports of thick black fog slowly rolling and moving underneath the trees and the underbrush in this forest, and people have claimed to see glowing eyes floating about in that fog. Now, I say again, is this just a normal fog? Is this just something, is the glowing eyes nothing more than lightning bugs? Do they even have lightning bugs in Romania? I don't know, but I would like to brush it off as that's all it was. But if it's not, what is that? A black rolling fog. There's even been people go and test with EVPs in that area, and they say that you can get like a radio or even a cell phone and have it out, and you can start hearing voices coming through those devices. Now, how wild is that?
That's crazy.
Now, here's even crazier too. Now, we talked about some ghost activity that's been found there. They've seen flickering orbs and dancing lights and things in these trees that they don't know where they come from in this forest. Just out of nowhere, boom, they blink in, they mess around, and then they're gone again, right?
Yeah.
Now, they've been studied by several paranormal investigators using all kinds of equipment, everything that they can basically pack over there and buy there and all that. Anything you can imagine they're using as far as equipment to try to figure it out. Thermal detectors, infrared cameras, EVP, anything you can do to try to figure it out. And this is what they've come down with. These orbs, they can't show that it produces any heat. So any thermal imaging equipment has failed to turn up any heat signature for them. So if it was an insect, you would see a heat signature. You would see an insect on the thing. So basically, you're seeing the orbs, you pull up the equipment, and there's nothing in the equipment screen. Pull it back down, the orbs are still there. They said the strangest thing about it, isn't what almost sounds insect-like to me, is the random appearance and activity. Just out of nowhere. Here they are, then they're gone. So that would almost lead it to be something more of a natural nature, but maybe it's not, because people are now believing that it's poltergeist activity, and that they believe it's everywhere in the forest because of this. There are tales of people out there trying to do things where camera bags and videography bags have been just snatched off of the owner's person and throwed up into the brush, throwed up into tree limbs, throwed to the ground. People have even reported being tripped or pushed down by an unseen force in this forest.
Wow.
The one such occurrence that I'm going to talk about actually happened when Destination Truth did a television show there. And one of the crew reported that it was violently attacked by an invisible aggressor. Now, the fella named Evan on the show here was sitting in a clearing when there was a sudden flash of light and he was thrown across the clearing to the other side. Now, Evan was a little disoriented and found that he had inexplicable scratches all up and down his arms, despite the fact that he was wearing a long-sleeve shirt. Now, he later reported that shortly before the incident, he had heard a strange female voice, multiple voices of females behind him before being blown across the clearing, he said, as if by strong wind. The entire episode was captured on film, and they say it still remains unexplained. And it goes on to state that the Destination Truth team was also able to capture the mysterious orbs of light during filming their investigation. So, I have no clue, but here's what's really wild. It started getting more notorious in the late 60s. There was a biologist named Alexandru Sift, and he took several photographs of a disc-shaped object in the sky above that forest. Now, there was a military technician named Emil Barney, and on August 18th of 1968, captured a very famous flying saucer photograph over the forest. And in the 70s, the area, of course, was a hotbed for more UFO sightings and more unexplained lights. Now, Professor Sift was attracted, of course, by this. So then he went to sort of reading the stories, talking to the locals. He went and sat and spent a lot of time with them. And he went to numerous trips to this place. Back in even in the 50s, he would go in there. And he went all through it. Said he was trying to find all the spaces between the trees, looking, trying to see what could have possibly been causing all this stuff. It says he was even brave enough not to abandon his research. That's how he photographed this and what he called the umbrella. Now, there's some surprises have appeared since the photo developed. Of course, the frameworks can be seen besides this thing, this umbrella. There could be observed that there are many forms, lights, and figures that a human eye can't see. And Sif's research continued in the 1960s when more and more Romanian researchers looking for information, of course, started coming in there. So it's like he started something going down that path. So here's the tale of the bad sighting, the really neat sighting, I would say, on August 18th of 68, when Emil, we discussed this military tech, he had talked to some villagers and was talking to them about it, and they were like, don't go, man. Don't have anything to do with that forest. But he went. He decided to go anyway. He's going to go spend the weekend away. So it was him and his girlfriend, and they go up, and there was two other friends of theirs, and they all went up there around 1 in the morning it's getting firewood. And Emil said he found himself start crying, just out of nowhere. He's just crying. Well, back at the meadow with his friends, Emil said he saw something that looked like a UFO flying at low speed above the forest, but it wasn't making any sound. He said so he keeps watching it, and this machine suddenly began to glow. He said it was making maneuvers in the air that were unbelievable for aircraft at the time, which we hear that often. He goes on to say that after there was a strange show in the sky, this UFO sped up in a little slightly oblique direction. Well, so he's, following it through the camera. He managed to capture a video, basically, or a picture of movement in 3 frames. And he developed the film. And he sits there and he says with amazement that the photos of what international experts over the years have to classify as UFO, it is said to be the clearest images of UFO photographed in Romania, and undoubtedly some of the best images of any UFO photographed ever in the world. Now, Professor Emil, is in contact with several of Romania's prestigious ufologists, and they confirmed the authenticity of the photos, and they were actually analyzed and filtered by these folks. And then they were, of course, released. You can go online, you can pull them up, you can look all you want to. Now, they reached some new standards during 77, and they were presented to the International Congress of Acapulco when they were looking at all these photographs. There was a big, this big photograph thing, and they were published in all these books and magazines and all that. In 1993, this area was called by this one researcher the Active Welfare Paragraph 3, is what it was called, because it seems to be the center of what he claimed was paranormal phenomenon in the middle of Transylvania. So he actually goes on to talk about that the forest itself is generally discrete but continuous at times, that it proves more data than fans of spiritualism. So a lot of spiritualists have been going there trying to meditate, trying to spend time in there, trying to connect with whatever it is, because there seems to be what he claims, as Mr. Adrian claims, to be a connection between what is the phenomena in there and the people outside this forest. So it's almost as if there's a psychic ability for people that may not know they're psychic till they get there. They get there, they get to going, and then boom, they connect. So it's almost believed that everyone has this ability, but they don't know to what degree till they spend a little time in this forest or they get near this forest, which brings me back to the beginning of the conversation you and I had. Is this some sort of zone for that kind of activity? Just because it's a forest, what if it was a pile of rocks? What if it was a river? What if it was a mountain of snow and an igloo? It could be anything. But just because it's this old creepy forest of what's growing there sounds a little bit different. So there is this. There's a general consensus among these researchers that it is a gateway for interdimensional travel for the spirits.
Yeah.
So it's exactly what we said. Now, they said there's the fact is that the recently dead, that this is, it's believed, can enter a material physical side of the planet. Okay, that's what these spiritualists believing. And then basically they believe that this portal is there. So if you're newly passed away, this is a portal like could take you someplace else, almost like an in between the purgatory and where you're going to go. This is a portal that's like a bus stop, if you will, for these areas. Now, there was a UFO reported filmed in this area in 2002 by two of the local residents that lived on the top floor of a building on the outskirts of the little neighborhood there. And the UFOs were caught on film for 27 seconds. And it's described as a bright object in the sky shaped like a cigarette in the length of about 50 meters. And the UFO itself rose and then went across the sky until it went up into the clouds, like we've all heard, and disappeared. So, it's not like it just was a little one-time thing of UFO sightings and strange orbs. It's still going on today. Now, here's something that was strange, and I can't find if it is 100% legit or if this is still just a folklore story, but there is a case that involves a missing little girl. It talks about a 5-year-old girl that vanished in this forest, and then 5 years later appeared wandering in the forest again. But the strange thing was, is to her, no time had passed. She was wearing the exact same clothes she had been wearing 5 years before. Her clothes were found to be in good condition. And upon questioning the little girl on what happened, it became apparent that she had no clue what had happened. So, it's like she stepped into a time slip, froze in time, and then got re-released wearing the same clothes. Nothing had changed. And I don't buy that. I can't find anything else about it. But unless maybe she was 10, but her clothes were exactly the same. I don't know how they would have fit her. Who knows? But there were 5 other people that vanished in that forest, were also turned up later. Except this. In their case, they were all found dead. Now, a lot of these that were found was determined that they recovered these bodies. It says that they had died of suicide. So, there's some very iffy things about it. So you don't really know. Did they die of suicide? The minute I read those two tales, the first thing I thought of was missing 411. Are we dealing with something along those lines? Maybe so.
Well, you know, David Politis isn't the only one to write about these disappearances going on in the woods.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote mostly people going missing in national parks, okay? But there's another author, I think his name is Stephen Thompson or Stephen Stobbs or something like that. I can't remember. I'll have to look. But he's written some books also very similar to David's, but these are taking places in other places that aren't national parks. But apparently there's people going that are go missing all the time under bizarre circumstances. And that's why a lot of people think that there is something out there, whether it's a person or a Sasquatch or something like that, or if it's some kind of cult. There's stories that I read that where they find like tarot cards nailed to trees in areas where people go missing. Sometimes a Ouija board is found in an area where someone's gone missing and they just, you know, they never find them. Is it people abducting other people? Could be. Or is it some kind of area where, like, the person is actually slipping into the parallel universe, kind of like the show, what was that, The Fringe or something?
Yes.
Right? So, yeah. I mean, maybe that's possible. Maybe they cross over and then they can't come back.
Well, what makes me think that it's more that way is it may be like an overlap is this, because there's some really strange things that happen in this forest physically as far as with the vegetation. Now, we talked about how these trees seem to grow in a spiral. A lot of the trees in this forest look like, and you're picturing the forest in The Hobbit, or you're picturing forests, you know, where they have the old gnarly, something about twisted trees and limbs. Well, this is there. They have twisted trees and twisted limbs and these strange char marks all over there. But they say that there's a circular area about 300 meters wide in this forest that's 100% devoid of vegetation at all. And that they say when you go in there, you get very high electromagnetic activity readings and all your equipment can start going crazy, the whole thing. Now, they call it the dead zone in there. And nobody around there, all these investigations, can't really come up with a rational reason as to why there's nothing that will grow there. Now, soil samples have shown to be nothing out of the ordinary or nothing that would distinguish it to be barren in this circle. It's just not growing. Now, get a load of this. It says, now, the complete mystery as to why electronics were brought into this circle, you really can't study a whole lot except for the electromagnetics because of what's going on, because it's so high. But it says it's strong in the disturbances and also strong in anomalies in that area, and it's shown in the circle to exhibit abnormal microwave, infrared, and even radioactive readings in this circle. Now, locals in that area point to this, you know, this little path that leads up. They say it's the epicenter. And they claim that that's where the ghosts of the murdered peasants live, is inside that circle. Like it's a big, you know, I guess for the lack of a better word, a fairy circle, but it'd be an evil fairy circle. Nobody seems to know. There are documentaries online about this that you can watch. You can go and read about all this stuff. You can go look at these photographs. Nobody truly seems to know why this place seems so terrible. But there's one thing that's guaranteed. There's something went on here. And it's like what Kyle and I have discussed, and all of y'all have probably thought about whenever we've discussed it, is we brought it up when we talk about Slender Man. We brought it up when we talk about a lot of these things. Is this something that it started off with a little folklore, but everybody believing, did they create something there? That, you know, everybody's negativity. They always talk about prayer or good energy or something, that if you think and they get enough people really seem to be pulling, you can change a lot of things. You know, everybody, oh, I feel better. Or, oh, I help this. It's funny how that works. Did they create something here without really knowing it? You know, was it already a little bit off? And then the more people talk about it and believe in it and then pass it on and believe, it's almost like a tulpa. Did they create this spot? Or is it truly this thin veil? Because the more I read about it and read about the strange physical characteristics of the vegetation, the fact that it's devoid of things in a big circle, the fact that they've been seeing UFOs and charts, well, it sounds like that's a landing spot. A 300-meter area instantly sounds like, well, that's where they would set the ships down. The charred areas on the trees is from when they take off and land. I mean, it sounds like, are they hiding in there? What is going on? There's a whole lot more that goes on in there. As far as the sounds, the faces, the ghosts, the shoving, the scratches, I've got nothing. The missing people could be easily abducted. The suicides could be left to make to look like suicides. You know, we've covered the whole show on human mutilation. I didn't find, of course, and looked and didn't see anything about what happened to these people or what their names were or how they were found dead or if it was just remains. Was it look like it has a broken neck, so it killed it? It tried to hang itself, but there's no rope and there's just like a skeleton there. Well, that's kind of hard to tell. You know, who knows? There's a lot of strange things. But this itself is something that is there to be investigated at all. So if any of you listening want to go to Romania, if any of you listening are living in Romania, be careful, but get on down there. Let's take a look at this. Let's finally get a little information. Send us some photos if you've got some more. Like I said, just look it up. It's real easy to find. You can punch in the haunted forest, the whole thing, but it's H-O-I-A hyphen B-A-C-I-U. Pull that up. Do a little looking around. See what you think. We really enjoy it. It's some of those things. I wish I could go check it out. I would like to go see it personally and take a look at it.
I would love to go there, right?
It'd be fun, right? And to get the whole thing. Folks, I hope you enjoyed it. Stick around. We're going to take a little break. When we get back, we'll just discuss a little something and have some fun. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. I really enjoyed those stories. I don't know what it is, but I've been hunting and camping and things in the woods before. And you do start, for whatever reason, it feels like something's watching you or it's kind of right. dark. And I can visualize this. You know, I've never been to Transylvania, of course, but I can think about times when I was younger in the woods alone, hunting, walking to a stand or something. And even though I've been in those woods before, it does kind of get creepy in certain parts of the early morning or, you know, just as the sun's going down. So I put myself there. And when you're telling these stories, you know, I'm trying to visualize what it would look like. And that's what I draw on. And I'm sure that's what other people are thinking when you're describing these woods. You always think of Transylvania, like you were talking about, with werewolves and vampires and things like that. Very interesting. Well, if you want to watch a documentary on the Hoyabatu forest, I put links to it in the show notes. So check that out. There's about a 30-minute documentary on Vimeo. You can follow those links there and watch that. Also, during your segment you were talking about, and I couldn't think of the guy's name. The guy's name is Steve Stockton, and the book is Strange Things Are in the Woods. And there's another guy, this is why I always get it mixed up, there's another guy named Stephen Young, and he has a whole book series, like five or six books.
The quarterback?
Not the quarterback.
And the guitar player?
No, who's Stephen Young, the guitar player?
If you don't know, I'll show him to you.
Strange Things in the Woods, and then he wrote another book called Nightmares in the Woods, Taken in the Woods, Predators in the Woods, and Something in the Woods is Taking People. And I've only read two of those. They're very interesting. Like I said, if you're into Missing 411, don't think that David Politis is the only guy covering these stories. There are other authors out there, and I urge you to go check those out. Cam?
Yes.
What were you telling me you had somebody you wanted to thank?
I want to thank Jesse. I had something else completely planned, and then Jesse got a hold of me, and he's like, hey, brother, have you seen this? And the reason I said it, Jesse's a Matt brother. Folks, I know there's a lot of people out there that listen to the show that do Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. If you haven't checked out Jesse's work, do yourself a favor. Swing over to whitebeltsurvivalstrategy.blogspot.com or just look up WBS or WB Survival, White Belt Survival. You can find him on Facebook. He writes a bunch of blogs about jiu-jitsu. It's really great. A lot of the stuff that he covers, he writes it. He's constantly posting stuff on there. He's a great guy. He's a, you know, friend of the show, the whole thing. He does a great job. It's just fun, and it's one of those things. Go and support him. I mean, even if you don't do jiu-jitsu, just tap it in one time, boom, so you can see that what he's got, the whole deal. Follow him on Facebook. It's got it. And there's somebody else, too, that I want to tell you all about. Because I know we got a lot of coffee drinkers out there. Turkey Murk. That's right, folks. You heard me right. You can go on Facebook and punch in the word turkey and then give us a space and put in Merck, M-E-R-C-K. He makes handmade coffee mugs. And the ones he's famous for is called the Slow Joe. Basically, it looks like a rotting zombie head that's a coffee mug.
Right.
It is amazing. You can go to his website. It's turkeymurk.com, I believe. But you can go to his Facebook page. Of course, it'll give you everything on there. He's going, I talked to him not long ago, and I sure hope that he does it. I hope he does. We're trying to bump him into doing some crypto coffee mugs, folks. So yeah. If you're interested in this, go and take a look at his work. If you think it'd be fun, post him something up on there. Post something on his timeline that you heard us talk about it. Let's see if we can't get the ball rolling and get this fellow to build some awesome, like a crypto line of either Bigfoot or Slender Man or Black Eyed Kids. But when you see these coffee mugs, you're going to freak out. I did. And yeah, they are expensive. They're expensive, but they're all handmade. He doesn't make a lot of them. Now, I think he's actually going to push to where he makes like a master and then starts doing maybe some resin casting of the mugs one day. I don't know. But these are all handmade, hand-painted, hand-fired. They're amazing. They're beautiful coffee mugs, too. I mean, it's just,
they're
especially
awesome.
If you're into the kind of dark stuff that apparently we're all into, or y'all wouldn't be here.
Yeah, I picture Sam Sheeran drinking out of one of these in the morning.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Now, well, Sam and him need to get together and work on this stuff, because it would be, those two together would be some dark art, scary stuff right there.
I agree. Well, what else you got planned for your week, bud?
Man, I don't know. A little work, and I'm going to try to squeeze in. Now that we're getting later on in the stuff, like I always say, I want to try to do a little fishing later, things like that, but I'm fixing to brew some beers. I've been talking about it. We've been working on it. Seth up there at Mecca Great Estate, the malting place, he has sent us some stuff down. We are going to make some beers, some cans of beers down here in Tejas. So me and Kyle are going to get to brewing. We will definitely, when we start all that, we'll post some pictures. Of course, look, we're knuckleheads. I've done it a couple of times. I made a ton of wine, things like that. I've brewed beer a couple of times. It's taken some time off. I'm going to go back and brew some. I'm going to bring Kyle into the fold as a brewer. So we're going to sit down. We're going to try to make some beer. We'll post some pictures of it. We're still working on the video stuff because we're trying to get it where it edits together, looks nice. We're going to start putting out a monthly video on YouTube, and then we're going to, you know, start maybe doing a little more periscoping or a little videoing of what we're doing around here in the studio, and we're trying to just interact a little bit more, folks. So hopefully you'll be able to catch on a little bit more of the stuff we're doing.
Yeah, I can't wait to try out these beers. I think the first one we're going to make is Mothman Mead. Is that
okay?
Correct?
That's fine. Yeah.
Come up with some crazy crypto.
We got to come up with some of that stuff. So we'll see what happens.
I'd like to wish every father out there Happy Father's Day.
Yes.
This is a day late, but we haven't mentioned that. Yeah, I've got a pretty busy week going with the show. I think next Monday we're going to be doing a special episode. You want to make sure you don't miss out on that. Also, don't forget, if you'd like more, you can go to Expanded Perspectives Elite. Go to our website, expandedperspectives.com, and sign up for that. It's easy. And everybody, just stay out of trouble. Have a good week. For you Elite members, we'll speak to you on Thursday. For everybody else, we'll talk to you next Monday. I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hale.
Peace, y'all.
Master medicine. Master medicine. Master medicine. Master medicine.
If you're ready for 2010, make some noise!
This year you're gonna get that house. This year you're gonna buy that car. This year you're gonna go to school, hey, and be a superstar.
Yeah.